Start with the New York Times. Had a good team talking about their work on the New York Times archive. Thank you for bearing with me while we get we got the technical things ironed out. I'm Evan Gatehouse, and I'm here with my team today to talk about what we've been doing with migrating the New York Times archives. And a little bit later, once we say our piece, Ed is going to interrogate us and ask us some questions in the panel. So,
and we'll open it up for other people too.
Absolutely. So. Just to get things started, opening formality, the three of us work for a news organization called the New York Times. It is perhaps the most, it is arguably among the most significant English language news organizations on the planet. And if you haven't heard of it, I totally suggest you check it out. And if it's a valuable part of your daily ritual, why don't you consider becoming a subscriber? Today, you've got not one, but I think three folks from the New York Times. Myself, I'm an executive director of technology with oversight of search, archives, taxonomy, and a few other things, but those are the ones that are most interesting for this crowd. And I also have with me Jane Kotler, who can introduce herself, and then Sophia.
Hi, I'm Jane. I'm a software engineer on our Discovery Services team. And in addition to the work on the digital archives that we're going to be mainly focusing on, I work on two products called Time Machine and Switchboard, both of which you will also hear about today. I'm Sophia, I'm also a software developer. And in addition to the our archive work, I also maintain a back-end web API
So we're going to talk today and then have a discussion about a problem of archives, a problem that I think almost everybody in this room is familiar with. First of all, I can't say how exciting it is for me to be in a gathering full of people with whom I can discuss these issues with no preamble and lesser fear of boring my audience. It's been like a real pleasure. And the second thought I had about this gathering, this is the job of the memory hole gathering. And Orwell also he who controls the past controls the future. So look around. You control the future. So the problem of archives that we have to deal with today, that we're dealing with at the Times, and I suspect a lot of you are dealing with, which is how do you faithfully represent information created with one technology using another? This is, I would suspect, a familiar problem. And it's something that we've dealt with in many, many different ways throughout our history at the New York Times. And I want to talk about two examples and then hand it over to Jane and Sophia to talk a little bit more about more recent work in this. One of the first examples I could find of the Times needing to migrate information development from one technology to another one. I'm getting ahead of myself. Before I start talking about this, I want to just sort of level set about what we mean when we talk about the New York Times archive. The New York Times published its very first edition on September 18th, 1851, and since then we've published approximately 60,000 complete issues, spread across about 3,500 pages, 3.5 million pages, and those pages contain about 15 million articles. Now, that is the sort of print archive. Our digital archive is divided up into several different tranches as well. And the digital archive, is primarily divided into two main periods. Basically, before 1980, and after 1980. What happened in 1980? Well, in 1980, the New York Times decided that it was probably a good idea to start persisting the digital data, the digital text of the news that they were creating. I believe there was a digital production process in place before that time, but we did not persist that data. So from 1981 onwards, we have the full digital text of our archive. Before that, we have less stuff. So, like I said, one of the challenges we deal with is how do we take stuff that was developed for one technology and present it using another one. And one of the first examples of that was a system that we announced in 1968 and then launched production in 1972, and that system was called the New York Times Information Bank. And so this is actually an old problem for the New York Times. The data in question in this instance was the New York Times Index, which we had published since 1913 as a bound digital index of the contents of the New York Times. And it is and remains a very valuable research tool, but the fact that it wasn't digital made it pretty hard to search. So we decided that we would digitize that, and in that time period we did. I was supposed to be giving you a slide, so I apologize. And that system, when it launched, provided the ability to search our index digitally for both the newsroom and for outside clients. This is a picture of folks in the newsroom using this technology in the 1970s. So that's one example of how we've had to take new old technology and make it new again with new technology. A more recent example is an effort we've done called Times Machine, which is essentially a virtual microfilm reader. This is one of my favorite headlines the New York Times has ever published. It's actually, it was published 104 years ago today, and it is the maniac of Milwaukee shoots Colonel Roosevelt, he ignores wound, speaks an hour, goes off. it's a spectacular headline. I mean, my condolences to the president, and of course it's bad news, but still.
I mean, wow.
So the New York Times, the Times Machine was sort of conceived to address a challenge with that deep archive. As I mentioned, everything before 81 we didn't really have a text for. And so it wasn't born digital, and we weren't in a position to serve it digitally the way we would more contemporary stuff. And that was an extra challenge when you look at the vast sweep of our archive, that little graph with the number of articles we've published by year since 1851. And you can see that about 75% of the creative output of the newspaper was published before we had digital text. And we call that part the deep archive, and it consists of about 46,000 issues, 2.2 million articles, sorry, 2.2 million pages containing about 11.5 million articles. And that scanned archive consists of some pretty cool material. We have scans of all of the microfilm. Gosh, I wish it was scans of the original newspaper, but it scans of the microfilm. And we had that microfilm segmented, so we know where on the physical page the stories occur, and we also have some metadata. We have the headline for every article, we have the lead paragraph for every article, and we have what should be familiar to you, and what we affectionately call the dirty ASCII, which is the nasty OCR text that is good enough to build a search index, but you wouldn't want to trip. That's an example of why right there. And also we have that indexing metadata. So we have subheadings and abstracts for almost every article in that time period. So given that, we were like, we think this is the right set of ingredients to build a really cool experience for our users around our archive. So see if I can do this. Alright. So I want to tell you to sort of make the point about how we've changed things in our archive. I want to discuss with you John Fairfax for a second. I don't know if anybody here is familiar with John Fairfax, but he was the subject of one of the Times, I think, most spectacular obituaries ever. He passed away in 2012, and his life included an apprenticeship to a pirate. He once almost died at the hands of Jaguar. And his claim to fame was that he was the first person to row across the Atlantic solo. And so if you wanted, prior to the advent of Pines Fishing, and I should mention there was an earlier product called Pines Fishing as well, prior to the advent of the most recent edition of Pines Fishing, the way you would have found this article in our archive is you would have done a search, and you would have gotten a link to that article, and it would have taken you to this abstract page, which gives you the headline, that lead paragraph that I said we had, and then it contains a call-out, this stuff did used to exist, but you did have the opportunity of seeing the high-resolution PDF of that article. So what you get of that article is a scan there of Mr. Fairfax waving from the vessel in which he rode across the Atlantic, and the story, the break, and the rest of the story. And that's cool. Like, it's really cool to be able to see that original piece of the coverage, but here's the thing. Here's that same story in Pines Fishing. Same guy, same wave, same story, and you can follow the jump. It should be loading here, but this is the problem with live demos, right? So we turn off this, refresh it. All right. But the thing is, that story, that front page story, was in the lower left hand corner of the paper, because on that very same day, human beings walked on the moon for the first time. And that previous half of the archive would not have shown you that. Like, you wouldn't have had any context unless you happened to be really good with dates that January 20th, 1969 was a momentous day in human affairs and also a busy day in the news. It was also the day after Senator Kennedy was involved in a car wreck that had redounded throughout the years. The other thing that I really like about Pines Fishing is that it lets you not only see the articles, but also the ads. Mm-hmm. And the sort of pithy way that I like to talk about why this is cool is that the articles tell you what happened, but it's the ads that tell you how people were living. Mm-hmm. The Times happens to have several very cool ads in here. This is one of my favorites. I want to pay 110 here. Ah, yes. So this is July 20th, 1969. There's an advertisement in the paper for a music festival. It's called the Woodstock Music and Art Fair, an aquarium exposition to be held 3 weeks in the future. And I don't know, it looks like a pretty good lineup. I consider going to this. And conveniently, all I have to do is clip out this right here and mail it in with my checker money order, and I can get tickets mailed to me for Woodstock. So the Time Machine really has, I think, created a whole new realm of possibilities for folks, for our readers, and the general audience to really delve into this important swath of American history. So that's Times Machine, and it is something that we are very, very proud of, but it's an incomplete solution to the archive problem, because in the era of the web, users expect to be able to go to Google and type in the name of an article and get that article and read that article like they read any other web article. So for that reason, we also launched an initiative for archive transcription. The idea there is to take this old scan and actually pay an outsourcer to give us the full digital text of those articles and then put those articles online. So this is our original review for Star Wars in both scanned microfilm form and in article form. And the big problem that we really wanted to solve with this is that most of our archive doesn't really have a good presence of Google. Sure, those abstract pages are indexed for a significant portion of the archive, but the full text, the absence of the full text, and even more important, probably the fact that that text that was up there wasn't in our modern web framework, made it difficult for Google to index that stuff. Well, I shouldn't just say Google. I mean, it's search engines, aggregators, social media sites, all of that's important to have your stuff expressed in a legible way. So the solution to this problem was we ended up transcribing these archival scans, and first we transcribed 1964, and used that as a pilot, and decided, based on the results of that, to do 1960 to 1980. And so far, we transcribed all these articles, We published 1970 to 1979 online. And Google now indexes 672,500, approximately, new articles that were not previously searchable to the world. And now we can bring those readers to now those readers can find the things they're looking for and come to us and get that information in a way that we weren't able to before. So those are a few instances in which we at the Times have tried to take modern technology to give a new life to things that were created with an older technology. But that's not all. We've also recently embarked on an era to modernize the web content itself and bring that up to the standards and experience that one expects from a 21st century news publication. And to talk about that, I'm going to hand it over to Cindy.
So what about our new articles? I'm gonna talk about how we modernize our born digital legacy of content. So NewYorkTimes.com officially launched on January 22nd, 1996. As you might imagine, the web was very different back then. But in 2014, NewYorkTimes.com got a redesign, and the redesign included an updated article template which better served the needs of the modern web experience. But there was only one catch. We could only serve articles using the new template if they were in our current content management system. What about all the articles published before we started using the CMS in 2006? Well, they were stuck looking like this. So our team's challenge was to convert our legacy web content before 2006 into a format that we could import into our CMS so the users could view it in the new design. Essentially, our goal was to make an article from 2004, for example, look like it was published yesterday. So initially, we thought the problem was simple. We have an archive of XML files derived from print data, and we thought that all we needed to do was convert the XML into the JSON format required by the CMS. However, we quickly ran into an issue. We found that there were hundreds of thousands of articles missing from these years that were, or there were hundreds of thousands of articles from these years that were missing in our print archives. So we inspected a sample list of web articles from 2004. And as it turned out, some of the missing articles did exist in our print archives, but we needed to combine the print and web data to properly process them. And there was also some web-only articles that were totally missing from the print archive. So we had to revise our strategy to include both print data and web data in our pipeline. Now our questions became, what's the complete list of articles from 1996 to 2006? How do we identify which of the missing web articles correspond to existing print articles so we can combine them and avoid duplicate content? And which articles are web only? And how do we scrape that page for content and metadata? And finally, can we build a system that will process all of this data for each year easily and efficiently? So we started with a simple question. What do we include in our archives? It became apparent that there was no one definitive source of article data. We decided to compile the official list from four different sources: the print archive, site analytics from the past 6 months, movie theater and restaurant reviews, and also site maps. So once we have our definitive list, we designed a data pipeline to combine and convert all of the web and print articles into JSON for the CMS. Here's an outline of the steps required for each year that we process. And don't worry, this slide will make sense. Here, the yellow boxes are inputs into the pipeline, the print archive, and the definitive list of URLs. And the blue boxes are intermediary steps, and the green boxes are outputs. The pipeline outputs a file with the articles in new format as well as any articles that failed along the way. So, using the definitive list of articles, we determine which articles are unaccounted for in the print archive. Next, we obtain the raw HTML of the unaccounted articles from the web. At this point, we still don't know how to combine the web and print articles, and also we don't know which articles are web only. And in order to figure that out, we compare print article content to the web content using an algorithm that Jane will describe later. This allows us to combine the print and web data, remove any duplicate articles, and determine which our web articles are fully missing from the print archive. And next, we reprocess the combined web and print articles and convert into the proper format for the CMS. Because we can use the structured XML data from the print archives, so getting the article content and that data was relatively simple. And then we process the web-only data and convert that also into the proper format for the CMS. But in contrast with the print articles, we only had unstructured HTML data for the web for these articles. So scraping the article content and metadata was harder. And finally, we combine the outputs from the last step into one file and import it into the CMS. So to give an example of the scope of this challenge, here are the approximate numbers for 2004 alone. Out of the approximately 116,000 articles for 2004, about 56,000 of them were fully accounted for in the print archive. Another 42,000 required data from both the print archive and the web, and 15,000 articles were totally missing from the print archive. And finally, there were about 3,000 articles that we couldn't process for some reason. For example, the article no longer existed on the web, or it didn't have an article body. So what we learned from this project is that it's important to use more than one data source when modernizing our archive in order to avoid confusion. So now next, Jane's going to talk about some of the unexpected challenges we face. Hi. So, So Evan gave us some background on the context to this project. You know, where were we coming from, what information did we have, what was kind of the state of our world when we started this problem. And Sophia talked about the solution that we came up with, the broad kind of the pipeline that we designed to solve this problem. What I'm going to be talking about is all of the little things, some of them not so little, that we didn't anticipate, and in some cases could not have anticipated, because they were problems that came up in quality assurance, or problems that we realized were part of the scope of the problem that we hadn't known were there before. So the first thing that I'm going to talk about right now briefly is the first point, 1996. So it's not just 1996. What that really means is the representation for all of the years in which we couldn't just run it through the pipeline because the year was some kind of hybrid of, you know, some data is available and some data is available in a different way. For example, 1980 was like this, Evan mentioned it earlier, in 1964, since we'd run it through the pipeline previously, and now it's slightly different. So, though all of those years had to be taken into special consideration. The next three points I will go into after this, and then I'm going to follow it up by talking about the next steps, which is what is kind of the future of this project, what are potential problems that we're going to be facing after this. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is what Sophia mentioned, which was this step of the pipeline. How do we convert the print XML that we had with the web HTML that we scraped as the list of what articles we had that were missing. And we dubbed this process affectionately fusion because it was fusing one corpus of text with another.
If you want to know in detail how Fusion works, if you're a techy person or if you're just curious, then you can look it up on our blog, on the Times Open blog. We wrote a post about it. But to go over it briefly right now, basically the essence of the algorithm was looking for common phrases between one corpus of text and the other. So you can think of this by saying that, you know, some article might have a unique sentence that appeared in the print and then also appeared in the web and is unlikely to be found in other articles from that year. And so once you kind of go through and find articles that have a lot of matching words, you put it together and you say, okay, we think these articles match. Another thing that we have to mention is that for we intended to prioritize the print data over the web data, because even though right now we see digital data as canonical, before, the web was kind of an afterthought. So that's kind of an interesting mindset to take into consideration with the advent of the digital era, sort of. So the next thing that I'm going to talk about is search engine optimization. This is what an old article looked like before. Sophia showed it. And this is the URL that it had. So it was, you know, nytimes.com/year-month-day/, in this case, 27iht-scavis.team.html, which is completely unhelpful. In order to make articles easier to find in search engines such as Google, and also just to make them user-friendly so that when you see a link, you know where it's going to go to, we changed the URLs to something like this, which is the headline separated by dashes, for example. So as you can see, it's much more friendly. And the problem with this is that if we just decommissioned all of the old URLs, it would have led to link rot. I'm sure many sections on Wikipedia that linked to many New York Times articles would have been very unhappy had we just decommissioned all of the old URLs. And so as a result, we developed and currently maintain a system called Switchboard, which, you know, you can imagine what a switchboard is, and plug things on the back end. It's essentially a redirect system. So we store all of the references from the old URL to the new one so that the other sites that point to New York Times don't break, because we really don't want that. There are more cases of missing data in this archive. So Sophia already talked about the case of the missing articles and how we solved that with the fusion process. And this is going to be the case of the missing sections. So this is something that we caught in QA. And it explains that article transcription isn't perfect. So yeah, you know, you could do OCR, and even if you do it manually, sometimes there, you know, in 1% of cases, for example, there are going to be mistakes. And so what this one was this is just a section of an article that I screenshotted from the site, and, you know, one section ends, and then there's a section header, and then another section starts. So what we noticed during QA for some years was that some of the sections seemed to be blank. And we thought, well, this isn't good. Why isn't this transcribed? We can't put up missing pieces of our archive. Well, turns out the sections actually weren't blank. It was just that in the transcription process, there was a linking problem between the section headers and the text for that section. And so we made the user experience decision of, for those articles, taking out all section headings, because we thought it's better to have just all of the text in the article and maybe take out the sections than to have a very confusing looking, like, why is there a section missing? And then we're going to get a bunch of emails about why is the section there when it really is, which is very confusing. So in that case, we decided to take out information that we have in favor of providing a better user experience to our readers. Finally, I'm going to be talking about next steps. The naive first next step to do is to just transcribe more of our archives. We already have full text for all of the years after 1960, as well as all of the Civil War years, which is 1860 to 1865. And we hope to continue transcribing our archives so that one day in the future you can look at an article from 1851 on the New York Times website and read it as if it were published yesterday. So we think that would be amazing and super cool. Lots of positive. So something else that we want to do is put photos back into our archives. This is a screenshot from Time Machine from the Challenger explosion. And the New York Times is known for having many great photos, but unfortunately in our current digitization of the archive, those photos are all missing because it's extra work in putting them in, and we were really focusing on the text. And so in future iterations, we would love to be able to also publish the photos and have them in the articles and see how that would add, well, it would add to the experience, but to see, you know, how we could do that, because there's sort of complicated subtleties in, you know, where were the photos placed and how to refer to them and all of that. So, relatedly, and the final thing that I'm going to talk about in next steps is we want to eventually figure out if there's a way to do digital preservation. And what this means is to figure out if there's some way that we can meaningfully communicate the original journalistic intent of our archive as it was in its digital form. So, you know, this is not a particularly interesting thing to do that with because it, you know, has text, for example, but this would be more interesting to do with, let's say, photos, for example, and because there was a lot of editorial say and, you know, where do photos go and what photos are there and just all kinds of stuff like that. So with that, I'm going to hand it back over to Evan to conclude.
Thank you so much, Jane. Thank you, Sophia. The two of them have done, along with the whole team, a lot of really fantastic work. And I should emphasize on that those previous slides. Those are all things that we would like to do, but I don't want any of you to come away with the impression that those are like things that we are firmly committed to doing next. There's an awful lot of stuff on the roadmap. But I hope that you have. I hope that we've gotten across the point today that modernizing and preserving the archives of the New York Times is an ongoing challenge, and technology has this really annoying habit of not sticking in, not staying still. So we're always trying to keep up with it. But I hope we've given you some valuable context today, and I'm really looking forward now to the discussion. So thank you very much.
Obviously, a ton of work has gone into this, and it is fabulous to be able to go online and enter with a few strokes, just a few keystrokes, and find articles. And so, if I'm thinking about an archive, I'm thinking about how did this really look when it was published, and it seems like you make the decision that is not as high a priority as getting it into the modern content management system. Can you discuss a little bit about your process or your decision to not, I mean, there's obviously economics involved, but
sure, I'd like, I should add a standard disclaimer here, that I am a technologist first, and I am not a representative of our editorial staff. So I don't want what I'm saying to be construed as the editorial position of the New York Times on this issue. But if it was my feeling, as somebody who was pretty close to this project, that our that the biggest service we could do to our readers with our archives was to put it into a format that made it easy to consume, but not just because the design is better, the design is better, but also because those legacy frameworks that these stories were published in weren't optimized for search, and probably even more importantly, weren't optimized for mobile. So we thought it was a bigger priority to get these experiences ported to a stack that could support the sort of experience most likely to make this most useful to the largest number of people. That was my thinking about why we approached it the way that we did. I do, however, acknowledge, and it's certainly become even more apparent to me over the last couple of days of this wonderful event that you've organized, that is necessary, but not sufficient, and that we do need to think more critically about what can be done to preserve the original experience of these things. As was discussed in the panel earlier today, it's much easier to preserve print journalism because it's not this weird nexus of content and software. But because these legacy templates really are an intersection of those two things, finding a way that we can preserve that, and a way that we can preserve that for the long haul, is, I think, a real challenge. Because I doubt anybody in this room has much faith that the current crop of web standards will meaningfully be interpreted by software. So figuring out how we can preserve this without relying too much on the technology that was used to create it is a real challenge.
I just wanted to add something that, you know, with what you said about us having the archive more in a modern format, it's kind of a decision to make it more easily accessible and, you know, less, I guess, faithful to the original, even though we're going to be doing our best to put more of the original data in there. And so it's kind of a, you know, it's accessibility versus, it's sort of like a lost connection.
I also wanted to add that another benefit of what we're doing is, you know, as I had mentioned previously, we had all these different data sources, and the fact that we're standardizing the format that they're in is very helpful. Will be very helpful, I hope, for in the future if we want to make, you know, further changes to the archive or do something new with the data, that now we have it all in one format, so it's easier to, you know, batch process as opposed to having to go in and, you know, do something different for each chunk of years.
I'm going to open it up in a minute, but the access is clearly important. I mean, the news business is all about access. So that part of it I get. Here's what's on my wish list, though. It sounds like you've taken some web-only content and blended it with print content. Is there a way that I could sort out what appeared online-only, you know, that part of the experience versus the print experience at this point?
Well, you can look at Time Machine.
So I'm going to open up two browser windows.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting idea, and it's not really a use case that we've given a great deal of thought to. It does involve a question that we've had to ponder, which is, what is the definitive version of an article? Now, traditionally, the answer to that at the New York Times has been the late city final edition of the article, because that's the version that was sent off to the microfilmers, because it was the last edit of the story that made it in print. Now, of course, that's probably not the right definition anymore. But I argue that over at least some of the archives that we've done the modernization work for, that is probably still a reasonable office definition. But finding that right trade-off between calling out that something was digital only or print only, like I think doing that well would probably require us to do a degree of research into the sort of digital publishing history of the organization and really find out where that digital only current became significant in the organization. That's probably where we want to start making those distinctions. But
so
I totally understand.
Is there a New York Times of record policy?
Well, the official archival version of the paper is actually defined as the late city final edition. Those definitions, I feel a little silly admitting this, but I'm not totally certain what the official definition is at this point. But that is the traditional definition.
Questions?
Thank you for your presentation. So, if say a researcher wanted to do text analysis on the entire corpora of what you have in your collection, would they be able to do that? Would they have to have a subscription? What if they were working in a group? Could they get one subscription for the whole group? And would they be able to do, like text analysis on the entire corpora?
That's an excellent question, and one that we've tried to answer by something that we did several years ago now that I was involved in, called the New York Times Annotated Corpus. So there is, I'm sure many of you are familiar with this organization in Philadelphia called the Linguistic Data Consortium, which is kind of like a chemical supply store for, information science and computer science experiments on language data. The Linguistic Data Consortium has this collection, the New York Times Annotated Corpus, which is available to members for free and to non-members for a few hundred dollars. It contains every article we published between 1987 and 2007. Now, I realize that's not the entire sweep of the archive, but it's a fairly substantial collection. It's well in excess of a million articles and a billion words. A data set that I believe last time I checked, Google Scholar, had been the subject of somewhere in the neighborhood of like 300 scholarly articles. So we're really happy that that data is out there and that it's available to the community. Now, if you wanted to do something more broad, the answer is, well, you could probably double the amount of data, but pretty quickly you would run out of full text data because we don't really have that going back beyond 1960. If one were interested in working with that, I think the best strategy is to get in touch with me and we can see what sort of arrangements might be.
Thank you for a very interesting presentation. I enjoyed it quite a bit. My question has to do with something that's often left behind in projects like this, and I wondered if it was a part of your project. You've obviously made a lot of decisions along the way to go one direction or another. I wondered if there was a documentation process for this whole thing, kind of above and beyond something like this, but actually are you documenting all the different decisions, which is kind of a preservation type of activity?
Well, I think
you should
have been
I will say that, as was mentioned in an earlier talk, GitHub, the version control system, and all of our code that we've been using for this project, we've been storing in GitHub. So, pretty much all of the, if you use version control as a type of archive, all of the changes that we've made along the way will be preserved there. So that's one way that we could be able to go back and see what decisions we made in code.
Also, in terms of, well, since we answered about code, I'm going to talk more about design decisions. In terms of those, I mean, we have regularly scheduled meetings for this project, and so every week we kind of we record minutes of what decisions we made, and so there is a document that we have that details the history of all of the decisions we've made. And so, is it in a super organized form? No, because we didn't really put it into that, but we do have a record of all of the decisions, yes.
And this is not the first content migration that Times has done in its history. And I can assure you that one of our goals is to make future generations happier with the documentation around this migration than we've been with the previous migration.
I have
one back there.
I have two questions. Jane in particular mentioned user interface decisions or user decisions. How did you arrive at those decisions? A/B testing, parking users in a room and watching what they do, or some other way? And the second question is, how have you future-proofed your current design for storing data?
So I guess I'll take the first question. Well, in the example that I mentioned with the missing, well, appearing to be missing sections, what it really was is that when we were QAing it, we thought, this is very confusing. And so we tested it on ourselves and we kind of sent it around to people internally to make that decision. I can't say we did A/B testing, but we did come to a general and pretty wide consensus that this was, in that case, that was a better option.
And also, just want to clarify that our team is actually not involved in the actual front end design of the web pages. So that's an entirely different team, which is focused on that, and they have put a lot of work into figuring out what is the best user interface design for not just this app, but all of our web components.
And one of the things about the design that I'm really happy about is that we haven't migrated all of the content. Because right now we've migrated all of our content from 1996 onwards and from basically 1970 to 1979. So there's still sort of a donut hole in the middle of stuff there that we need to migrate. But a decision that we made in collaboration with our design folks that I'm really happy about is that we decided that we launched our website in like April-ish of 1996. Our website just turned 20. There were blog posts about it. And we made the decision that in the design for the archive landing, for the archive pages, prior to that day, in 1996, we linked to Times Machine. Because prior to that day, there wasn't a website. So we just made the decision that prior to that day, it's important that that image of the newspaper and that link to that print experience, we thought that was important to provide with our users, and we were gratified that the design department helped us realize that vision.
And you had also asked about future-proofing, and I'm going to go back to a point that I made earlier about the fact that we've combined all these different data sources into one format, so that's, I think, it's one way of future-proofing is now that it's all consistent, that's a lot easier to deal with when we want to make changes in the future than dealing with different changes. So, I'm sure, hopefully if the time's around for another 100 years that, there's going to be more changes, but it'll all be in one format now.
But I think ultimately, when it comes to future-proofing this stuff, if anybody here knows what the future is, I want to talk to you. But I think you do your best and hope that the decisions you're making are going to lead to a good outcome.
Is this for mobile or just for desktop?
All of this stuff is both mobile and desktop friendly.
And are there translation features or options? I have international students.
Sure. Right now, this content is available almost exclusively in English. I should say that our coverage today is available in, at least parts of that coverage are available now in three languages. We publish a Chinese language website, and we publish a NYT in Espanol. So those three languages are the languages primarily served by our organization. But in terms of the archive stuff, that stuff is all in the original language publication.
And I think that's going to be the last question. Thank you, New York Times.